The Athletic Support is brought to you by GameTime, your new go-to app for the best deals on last-minute tickets. Did you know Canadians' ticket prices tend to drop right before the game starts? GameTime tracks prices in real time from thousands of trusted sellers, then shows you all the best last-minute deals with prices up to 60% off. More than 12 million fans have downloaded the GameTime app and discovered the fastest, easiest way to get into the game. The great thing about the GameTime app is that it's an easy two-tap checkout. And there's not only games available on there, there's also concert tickets and other events. So head to the App Store or Play Store, download Game Time, and score awesome deals on last-minute tickets.
Welcome to the Athletic Support. I am Marc-Antoine Godin, alongside Arpin Basu. Arpin, hello.
Hey.
Hey. Canadians are fresh off two losses
in a row. They lost a couple in a row.
I know. For the first time in this season, did they lose two games in regulations in a row.
Panic in the streets.
No kidding. I know. But you know what? You know, I heard panic from one guy in particular, Claude Julien, and that's specifically regarding his penalty kill. And in my mind, it's entirely justified.
It is. And I think that there's a certain sense of urgency to get it fixed, because already you could say, well, first of all, the two-game losing streak that they're on is a direct result of their penalty kill. They've had at least two other games this year where they did not get the full 2 points as a result of their penalty kill, perhaps even more. So already you're looking at anywhere between 4 and 8 points in the standings, or 6 points in the standings. That's tied to one very specific aspect of their game. One aspect of their game that no one thought would be a problem coming into this season.
No, because they've been good. They were good last season. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much the same guys.
Well, they were bad at the beginning when Weber wasn't there, but as the season went on, they turned into a very, very effective penalty-killing team, you know, bolstered by the addition of Nate Thompson in February and what have you. So Nate Thompson's been good on the penalty kill. Mm-hmm. He's just about the only one. But, you know, I mean, I think there are justified reasons to be freaking out about the penalty kill right now. But, I mean, you know, you look at their play at 5-on-5 and you look at the power play. I mean, things are not – it's not a disaster at this point, because, you know, in my mind, and this is what I wrote last night, and you can read it now at The Athletic, but, I mean, basically to me, you know, if you pick 5-on-5, power play, penalty kill, if there's one of those three phases of the game that you would think is the most fixable of the three, in my mind, it's a penalty kill.
Right.
It's a question of – tactical adjustments, making, you know, as Claude Julien said after the loss to the Sharks, you know, making certain things very clear to certain people and you know, just better defining roles, identifying where the mistakes are happening. But, you know, there's no real, you know, you never hear of a team that says, oh, we got to go out and get someone to help the penalty kill. It's just not something that teams do. It's really incumbent on the coaching staff. And so we'll see if this coaching staff can make those adjustments. But, you know, based on Claude Julien's long history as a head coach, he rarely has a tremendously bad penalty kill over the course of an entire season.
Right. I calculated that, you know, during his time in Boston, on average, the Boston Bruins had the eighth best penalty kill in the league while he was their head coach. But it's worth saying, though, that two years ago, the Canadians finished 30th. And it cost J.J. Daniel his job.
Yeah, they were quite bad, and they never got better. No. And, you know, but, I mean, I think there were some mitigating factors there, the first of which being, you know, Carey Price was terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrible, and was particularly terrible on the penalty kill. There are a number of fans after the game against San Jose who are saying that he's been terrible so far this season. And there was actually one comment on my piece from after the Sharks game asking that we talk about Carey Price on the podcast. So we're going to do that.
Right.
Do you think it's justified to say that Carey Price has been terrible?
No. No. But he doesn't need to be terrible to not meet expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectations are probably not at this point in his career that he's the best, he's going to be the best goaltender in the league, but he's got to show that he's among the elite. He's not too old for that. He's as far as we know, he's healthy. So he's, you know, and he's got his tools have not magically disappeared. So far, what we've seen from Carey Price is a goaltender who's okay. He's been good. There's been periods where he bailed out his team, but overall, he's not in a mode. I don't see the Carey Price of last.
He's not erasing mistakes.
No, exactly.
He's not erasing mistakes, which is what he gets paid to do.
Yeah, and you know was it the Melker Carlson goal?
Yeah,
yesterday.
The fourth goal.
You know, so Carlson gets a prime shooting location. You know, he's right at the hash mark. He's got clear shot, no pressure next to him. It would have been great if Carey Price had made that save, but to pin it on him, saying, "Well, he should have made that save." It's more. I see it more like a projection of people hoping that he's going to make that sort of game-changing save, and that's probably a time of the game where it could have happened. But on that particular shot, I mean, it's any goalie's vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, and I don't mean necessarily to defend him. I think I expect more out of Carey Price personally. And the thing is, the Canadiens, the way they're built, with the contract that they've given him, they cannot allow themselves to have a Carey Price who's just fine.
Yeah,
you know, he's got to be better than good.
Yeah, the standard's very high, and I think more in that San Jose game. I saw a lot of people upset about the Melker Carlson goal, and maybe it's justified. I don't particularly see it. You know, I think that puck, you know, came in and out of the net really quickly, hit the top corner. It was a good shot, but it was, you know, the puck was on edge. It was kind of a weird, fluttery sort of shot. And frankly, the Canadiens should not have been allowing a guy to shoot from there. But the expectation, I think, is reasonable, is that people, for the number of times you've heard the general manager of this team say that Carey Price is our Sidney Crosby, is our whatever, he's our superstar.
Right.
You know, superstars... The bar for a superstar is sometimes unreasonably high. You know, if Sidney Crosby goes 10 games and has 7 points, people will be like, well, what's wrong with Sidney Crosby?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, Connor McDavid recently had a 3-game point streak or pointless streak, and people are like, what's wrong with Connor McDavid? 3 games, no points, and you know, he's never had a 4-game pointless streak in his career, but that's the bar. And so in Carey Price's case, you know, he's paid what he's paid, and he has the position on the team that he has, because mistakes like the one that led to Melker Carlson having that shot from the location he had it in, with the lack of pressure he had, he's in a way paid to erase those, and he didn't do that in that case. But I mean, you know, and he's had some other games where he's been less than outstanding. Let's say, because his numbers reflect that. You know, he's hovering around 900 save percentage.
Yeah.
He's in the 280s goals against average.
He's very average.
But the Canadiens have also been very leaky. You know, go back to the penalty kill. And yes, your best penalty killer is your goaltender. But, I mean, there are, you know, you look at their first power play goal the Sharks scored in that game Thursday. And, you know, I mentioned it to you on the way home from the game, you know, how they Royal Roaded the hell out of that power play, right? It was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Right.
Carey Price did not look great because he's swimming around in his crease. He's trying to figure out where the puck is. Doesn't really, really identify where it was by the time the shot came and bounced off Evander Kane's skate. But, you know, is he supposed to stop seam passes going back and forth all the time? I mean, there's certain limits to what a goaltender can do on a penalty kill. And somewhat the same deal on the second power play goal where, you know, where Timo Meier gets the puck right in front of him and has an outlet right next to him that's left with a wide open net, and I don't really see what Carey Price could have done there. So I think, you know, I think he gets judged to a different standard, and I think that's fair, that he should be judged on a different standard because of who he is and the position and his importance to the success of the team. But I don't think he's been quite as bad as people might be saying he is? Are people even saying he's that bad? I don't know. But last night during the game on social media, even in some of the comments on my story, I just got the impression that people are judging Carey Price's season maybe a little harsher than it deserves to be judged. I think it deserves to be judged harshly, but not to the extent that I think it is right now.
Well, actually, his beginning of season is not too different than what it was last season.
Yeah.
He started off like by being just okay. And he had in October, but while the team was winning, because the team was scoring tons of goals at that point.
Just like now.
Yeah.
they've been scoring tons of goals.
I know, but
not in the last two games, but I mean, generally speaking.
Right. But they didn't have a leaky penalty kill such as the one they have right now. So, and then there was this dip mid-November, and then from the end of November on, he became the Carey Price that we know, and that I think the organization was expecting to see again. So it's a bit of a slow start. But it seems like an impossible situation, because he's got an okay supporting cast around him, but he's still being asked to steal games once in a while.
Yeah, and again, that's fair. That's what high-end, top-end goalies do. They do steal games occasionally. They do get on heaters where they seem unbeatable, where they get intimidating. You know, I don't get the sense that Carey Price is intimidating anyone right now. He's not necessarily stopping shots. He has no business stopping. You know, he still makes the occasional spectacular save. He's had a couple of games this year where I feel he's been really good. I thought he was really good in St. Louis in that game. You know, and a couple other times, but it's, you know, this is the burden that he lives with. And I don't think he would want it any other way. He likes being the guy.
Yeah.
He's expressed it many times. I feel like I'm a guy who can make a difference and get a team over the hump, be the difference maker that gets a team over the hump. And, you know, right now he's not that specific guy. Right now he's not the biggest problem on the Canadiens, far from it. And frankly, I don't think there are big, huge problems on the Canadiens, just to be clear on that. But you know, he's not making a difference in a positive way, the way that he himself expects to do.
Who do you consider is the bigger concern between Price and Weber?
I don't know. It's a good question, because, you know, the thing with Weber was that I expected to see him kind of shoot out of the gates here and have this sort of rejuvenated
after a summer long
training and after missing all that time with injury, really for the first time in his career, well, the second time, but the first time in a long time that he's missed a significant amount of time with injury, and he's never missed that much time with injury. You know, I think my expectations for him were a lot higher than what he's actually performed at. I would be a tad more concerned about Weber and just the way he's slowly rounding into form. I think he's been better lately than he was at the beginning of the season.
Yes.
But it was interesting. I was talking to a scout about him earlier in the season when he looked really bad. And he was, you know, he was, as soon as I mentioned, like, what do you think of seeing Weber these days? And he was like, I'm not worried about him. And, you know, hockey people say that about Shea Weber all the time. He'll be fine. He's great.
Yeah.
He's the best. He's this. And but what he said is that, you know, bigger guys always start slow.
Okay.
I was like, oh, okay. Well, maybe that's something I should consider. I think that a part of the reason for that is that the officiating standard is so high early in the season that bigger guys can't get away with cheating. They can't get away with little holds, and little hooks, and little cross checks like Shea Weber likes to administer, you know. And he got called for a hooking penalty against San Jose. Weber said afterwards that he thought the guy held his stick and sort of baited the refs into that. And let's be honest, the refs did not have the greatest night in the world in that game on either side. You know, for both teams, got really questionable penalty calls. But I think of the two. To answer your question,
yeah.
Of the two, I think Weber is the more legitimate source of concern right now.
Okay, yeah. But I think everybody's comfortable with the idea that that Jeff Petrie is now the number one defenseman on this team, and that, you know, it's we've been there's been so much talk regarding the fact that there was a need for a left-handed defenseman. Claude Julien alluded to that himself the other day by saying, "Well, Mark is still looking for a number one for a defenseman on the left side." But is it going to be a defenseman that's going to help the Canadians, or a defenseman that's going to help Shea Weber? Because Shea Weber, being who he is, should not be the one needing help. You know.
No, but it would be nice to have someone that Claude and Luke Richardson and the coaching staff in general was more comfortable using for 22 to 24 minutes a night than having Victor Mete there and sort of having a different partner on the penalty kill and then a different Simon on the power play. And then it's just, you know, it becomes complicated when you're trying to sort of, like, this jigsaw puzzle of ice time on defense would be a lot less complicated if they could just throw Weber's pairing out on the penalty kill, whoever his partner is.
Right.
Throw them out on the first penalty kill unit and they play together and that's it. And you know, I was talking to Jeff Petrie after the game in Minnesota about, you know, the fact that he had, at that point, had been playing with Weber on the penalty kill, on the first unit of the penalty kill for a couple of games, which was new. You know, it's Jordy Benn was in that spot last season, and I think it's fair to say that Jordy Benn is somewhat missed at this point on the penalty kill. You know, I'm not willing to pin all the problems on the departure of Jordy Benn because that would be ridiculous. But Petrie was saying that it's similar to how getting a new partner at 5-on-5. There's a chemistry that needs to be built. There's communication that needs to happen. We need to be able to read off each other. We need to know when the other one's going behind the net. The other one needs the net front. And there was, you know, there was a miscommunication on a goal in Minnesota when both Petrie and Dano went up to Mikko Koivu, leaving Jason Zucker alone in the slot for a nice tip off of, like, a shot pass from Koivu. But, you know, there were certain communication issues, and when Petrie says it's probably just as hard for a partner, it's not all that different, I would imagine, when the forward group's involved. Because, yeah, you know, it was often Dano, Lehkonen, Weber, Ben. That was the foursome that was out there on a penalty kill. So that was, you know, that goal in Minnesota was a matter of Petrie learning to read off Dano and it not clicking properly, because under that circumstance, it was probably Petrie who should have gone to Zucker and Dano that should have gone out to Koivu because Zucker was moving down the slot. But in any case, it'd be nice if you didn't have to do that. If you weren't throwing a guy into a situation where he's constantly looking for chemistry with his partner.
Right.
And it'd be good if so, but they don't have that. And that's why I think Claude Julien's point is, I'm working with what I have. When he says that, you could see it as a veiled shot as his GM, but it's something he says a lot. Like, it's,
yeah,
because he's a coach and these are the players I have.
There are some times where that sentence is more meaningful, as carries more weight than, yeah, others. I felt that this time was one that it carried more weight, but it's not a shot at his GM, but it's just an honest assessment of how things are, you know.
Yeah.
And it's but you know, I understand Petrie's point regarding finding chemistry on the PK, because even more so than at 5-on-5, you're constantly under fire,
mm-hmm,
so you're constantly under pressure. You need to get your act done and
you
know
need to make
exactly
decisions quickly. Instinctively, you know?
Exactly. Like, you need to trust your partner, too, and mm-hmm, not try to do his job.
Yeah.
And just manage to do your own, because otherwise, you know, people are going to start going one side and the other, like if it's a boat that's rocking constantly, such as it looked like that at times yesterday. So back to Weber. I mean, of course, right now, Weber and Petrie are the two players in the league that have been on the ice for the most goals against on the PK.
Yes.
The two forwards that have been on the ice for the most goals against are Danu and Lehkonen in the league. So it doesn't paint a pretty portrait, because those are usually your trustworthy guys. So,
well, I mean, just to explain that to people is that I don't know what the... I should have looked this up, but I would imagine that the opposing... The amount of time the opposing power play needs to score against the Canadians right now is minute. It's in the first 30 seconds of the power play that they're getting goals more often than, and definitely the first minute, and more often than not they're scoring before that first unit is able to get off the ice for the Canadiens. They haven't managed to clear the puck, and that would explain Weber Petrie's numbers being so high, even though they've each been on the ice for goals separately. And Dano and Lekkonen's number being so high because, you know, Dano has been losing faceoffs more often
than
not.
That's an issue, yeah.
On the penalty kill. And that leads to zone time on that unit. And that zone time has led to goals at a very, very high rate of frequency. And I'm a little surprised. And, you know, maybe we'll see it on Saturday. Maybe we'll even see it in practice in about an hour. I'm a little surprised that, you know, in the way that the Canadians started using the quote-unquote second power play unit to start power plays, how Nate Thompson has not been starting more penalty kills of late, because, you know, it's kind of the elephant in the room right now is Phil Deneau's play defensively, not only on the penalty kill, but just in general.
Is that the elephant in the room? My God, I feel it's a room full of elephants.
Well, because I just feel that's not being talked about, you know, like Carey Price is being talked about, and that's... It's not an elephant in the room because people are so willing to talk about it. And Shea Weber, I think there's a large pocket of fans who almost expect him to start declining. So it's not a shock to those people. But, you know, Phil Deneau not excelling in defensive situations is an unexpected development.
Yeah.
It kind of comes out of nowhere. And, you know, admitting that or making decisions in consequence of that. And I think we saw that a little bit against the Sharks, which we'll get into in a sec, but that's a thing. That's a thing that's been happening in these 10 games that not a lot of people are talking about, that Philip Deneau has been so-so in his own end without the puck.
Yeah, because when you look at the Canadiens and what they were targeting, the areas where they were targeting to get better at, you know, over the course of summer, there was talk about the power play, they changed their backup goalie, etc. They addressed certain issues, for the most part. I mean, it's done some okay results. We'll probably get to Ben Chiarot a bit later on. But there are some corrections that have been made, but they were also working on the assumption that everything that went well last year would continue going well.
Yeah.
And that's not a given from year after year. You know, that Dano line, not only Dano, but Tatar also is off to a rocky start. And you got guys that have completely disappeared, like Paul Byron, you know.
Right.
So, but Dano, as a guy who was close to being nominated for the Selke Trophy, I mean, he finished what, fifth? No, he finished, I think, seventh in the ballot.
Right.
Because he did not get a nomination, but he really knocked at the door.
Right.
And you know, it's probably and you compared it to the Hall of the Baseball Hall of Fame. You know, once you get your name in there in the discussion,
whether it's warranted or not, you'll start getting votes.
Yeah.
Patrice Bergeron turned into essentially an offensive zone start guy for the Boston Bruins when Bruce Cassidy took over. He started short-shifting them in the offensive zone. He would give them off to send out a guy, and you know, Max Pacioretty talked about it at length, how he couldn't believe. It seemed like Patrice Bergeron was always on the ice with the puck in our zone, because he was coming off the ice as soon as they lost the puck, and as soon as they got the puck back, he was jumping back on the ice to go on offense. Like,
right.
He's basically become an offensive specialist for the Bruins, but was still a finalist last year for the Selke. He is a great defensive player, but you know, it's not a reputation award.
Right, it's not a mission from the same mission that he got like 4 or 5 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but Dano is not on path, let's say, to be in that discussion this year the way he's been playing, unfortunately. But, you know, it's still the season's still early after 10 games in. Do you think that usually we take the 10 game mark as a good time to evaluate. Yeah, it's a segment, but it's the right time to evaluate what a team has got, what the team doesn't have. Are you comfortable with the team, with what the team has right now, and its ability to be more than just a win one, lose one type of team?
I am personally. You know, a lot of the underlying numbers the Canadians had last season that drove their success are still there. You know, they're a top 10 possession team. They're a top 10 team in scoring chance differential. They're a top 10 team in expected goal differential and goal differential at 5-on-5. 5-on-5, things are going pretty well in spite of the things you mentioned that, you know, Tatar got off to a slow start. He's picked it up. Danault's been so-so. But that line in general is the one bread-and-butter line the Canadians have and, by and large, have been effective at 5-on-5 as long as they have the puck, which they do often. Otherwise, you know, we saw the Domi-Drouin combination reunited against the Sharks. I thought they had a pretty effective game. We're going to talk about that in a second, I think, and the piece you wrote last night. But, you know, in spite of Paul Byron being a total non-factor, like not being a threat offensively whatsoever and not even being all that great defensively, he's just kind of there. He's just sort of blah so far.
The speed has disappeared.
Well, he doesn't have that burst. He's not challenging... he's not putting pressure on opposing defensemen. He's not creating turnovers the way he usually does. He's not getting breakaways the way he usually does, and not scoring on those breakaways the way he often did. But, you know, it's so there are a lot of things going on, but there are a lot of things that this team has that this team did not have when it started the season last year. You know, a line of being able to trot out a line of Nick Cousins, Nick Suzuki, and Nate Thompson as your fourth line is leaps and bounds ahead of the Nick Deloria, Charles Houdon, Matthew Pekka line of a year ago. Having a guy like Jordan Wheel not in the lineup is leaps and bounds ahead of what they had. You know, last year their big solution to the fourth line was Michael Chaput and Kenny Agostino. We are far, far away from that. So I think the way they're playing in general is good. The base, the foundation of their game is there. There are a few things around the fringes that need to be fixed. And the reality of the NHL is that they don't have a ton of time to fix it. I mean, if the penalty kill keeps costing them games, then we might be in a situation where we're looking back in March and saying, man, those penalty kills, that penalty kill back in October really cost this team a playoff spot. Even if they do get it fixed in November or whatever. So, but I'm personally of the mind that this team's playing a lot better than the record shows, because the record's skewed by that penalty kill. But I'd be a lot more concerned if they had out of this world special teams and their 5-on-5 play had suddenly slipped, because to me the identity of this team is being able to perform at 5-on-5 and control the pace of games, the way they have by and large this season.
Right. Well, Claude Julien has always preached first that 5-on-5 play was more important than special teams because you play the most of the game 5-on-5, so this is what you need to have correct at first. That's the first thing in order. And second, I think he values the PK more than the power play, because if you fail at the PK, you give up a goal.
Yeah.
If you fail at the power play, you just don't score a goal.
You break even. Yeah.
So it's more. It'll cost you more probably in terms of percentages. Although last year we saw the limits of that logic, because you know a goal here and there, a goal more on the power play here and there might have made a difference in the Canadiens' power play. But it's this season. It's funny. Things have gotten. Okay, well, very good actually on the power play for the Canadians, but I might be changing topics here, but it's the second unit that's really making a difference. The first unit with Drouin and Weber and the focus on giving the puck to Weber to shoot it, the same issues that were there last year seem to be, you know, they're very much existent right now. It's the second unit that's been producing goals for them. And you had thought at first that, at the end of the season, Claude Julien thought that the addition of Danault and Wheel in the power play was the key to, you know, create something, a new dynamic, new patterns of plays, and a more effective PP. But as it turns out, now Wheel is in the stands, and Danault's been taken off the power play entirely.
Yeah. I think my issue with that unit is that, you know, like Weber, if you watch Ovechkin on the power play, Ovechkin goes from the top of the circle to the goal line and back over and over and over and over and over again. He's never really standing still until the pass is coming.
Yeah.
That's to get away from the person who's clearly assigned the task, the unenviable task of preventing Ovechkin from shooting. He still gets his shots because he moves. But he's moving towards the net. He's moving in
he's
a range.
He's a backdoor threat.
He's a backdoor threat, and he's just in movement. Shea Weber's movement when that guy is there to prevent him from shooting is not to go towards the goal line. It's to go towards the blue line. And he's been fading away from the net almost instinctively. And, you know, I think you saw it against San Jose. There was that one time Mete cut right in front of him. That was not a power play, but still, that was that. I think that's indicative of what's going on here, is that Shea Weber was fading. He was taking, basically, it's like a fadeaway slap shot almost, like to use a basketball term, but he's fading from the net to shoot, to get away from his coverage, instead of forcing his coverage to respect his backdoor threat. And that's what, you know, before the season started, that's what I thought he was going to be doing. You know, and he can do that because he's actually pretty agile when it comes to like shooting pucks that are in his feet, and he doesn't have to wind up for a big slapper to have a good shot on net.
Yeah,
and so he would be a decent guy for that backdoor play. He's just not doing it. And I think part of that early on in the season, and even now, you could say is that he looks back and he sees 92 on the blue line. He's like, I don't feel all that comfortable leaving him as the only guy there. So he has a tendency to hang back more, but. In theory, the idea of getting Shea Weber off the blue line was a good one. He just needs to cooperate and do it. I don't feel he's been doing it. You know, it's he always, his instinctive move, and he said it himself at the end of last season, he's like, I will never see myself as a forward.
That's right.
On the power play.
I asked him about that.
You asked him about that, and he said, I will never be able to do that. And it's he's proving it this year. He's not playing like a forward, whereas that's what they need him to do. They need him to play forward on the power play. And he hasn't done it yet.
And they need a forward to play as a defenseman.
Well, he's been better this year, but coming into this year, they're least reliable defensive forward. But, you know, I think Jonathan Drouin has been great without the puck this year. It's been night and day from last year. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a trust issue there, but, you know, I think someone needs to sit Shea Weber down and say, listen, if we're going to get this power play to work, your unit to work.
Yeah.
We need to take advantage of the fact that there's one out of four guys on the other team that is constantly accounting for you. So that should make the power play into a de facto 4-on-3 situation if you take advantage of it properly. But if Shea Weber's going away from the net, the person who's responsible for him is not worried about him anymore.
Like, no.
You know,
they'll pay the price like Joel Eriksson Ek did the other day when Minnesota was in Montreal. And
they'll get in the shooting lane.
Yeah.
Or they'll pressure the shot because they'll have time to get to him. By the time the pass gets all the way out there, they have time to adjust. Whereas if you're hitting him on a backdoor pass, you don't have time to adjust. You have to be there.
Yeah.
So they need to... So that unit needs to do that, but I mean this.
I feel like this unit will get it going, and Shea Weber will start scoring goals when they first start figuring out other ways to score. They need to start developing other threats in other parts of the offensive zone, like the way last year at the end of last year when Dano, Wheel, and Armia created that little triangle. Teams adjusted to that and figured that out. Rather quickly in the early going of this season, but it produced results at the end of last year, and it's schemes like that that they have to figure out and take full advantage of the fact, as you said, that somebody's taking account of Weber being there, because if they just continue feeding him the puck, that strategy has been tried for so long, and it just doesn't produce results. On the other unit, the threat, you don't identify one threat. It comes from pretty much everybody. You know?
Yeah, it does.
And there's more.
But there's nothing
movement.
Wrong with that. That's fine. I mean, if the other unit is the first unit, not the end of the world.
No.
You know what? It's like it's being effective. They're spending time in the zone, and the most important thing compared to last year is that they're not sapping the momentum of the team. Like this team regularly builds momentum at 5-on-5 to the point where they force the other team to take a penalty. That's the most indicative thing of being on a power play is the fact that you've created enough pressure that has forced the other team to take a penalty. So you have momentum.
Yeah.
And last year, the momentum died as soon as the other team took a penalty. This year, it hasn't. And it's largely due to Domi and everyone on that second unit, Petrie being on that second unit, doing what they've been doing.
Although it was funny, after the loss against San Jose, to hear Drouin say, you know, we're so happy with our play 5-on-5 that sometimes we'd rather just not go on the power play and stay 5-on-5.
Well, he's on the wrong unit. That's what that answer said, was basically his unit doesn't get out there. But there's something else I want to discuss with you, and you wrote about it after the San Jose game, and I think it bears discussing because it's a big change for this team. I mean, Drouin and Domi going back together and being joined by Armia, you know, what are the... If that remains a thing,
yeah,
and let's say they played more than the Deneau line against San Jose. They were the top line for all intents and purposes in that game. How does that change the dynamic of this team?
Well, it changed the dynamics in many ways. First, when I just look at yesterday's game, 5-on-5, Max Domi started. Like, he had 8 draws in the defensive zone, whereas Philippe Deneau had only 3. So there is a trust factor from the coach to Domi and Drouin to have more difficult tasks to take care of. Mm-hmm. So he puts responsibilities into guys that are known specifically for their offensive production in order to maybe unload a little bit of the responsibilities of the Deneau line and help maybe that Claude Julien has come to consider that too much was asked out of Deneau, and he's got to recalibrate that. It tells me also that Domi and Drouin, and I would say especially Drouin, because that's the progress has been even more significant on his part, is how he has changed his outlook on the game and made himself being more aware and more involved player and a less risky player. And it was very interesting this week to hear him say that he says, if I want to make my shifts more effective, not doing the silly play that will cause a turnover, it's not only that it's going to cost a turnover, but it will exhaust me because it's going to force me to spend 30 seconds more on my own end. Mm-hmm. So how can I simply just avoid those turnovers, those risky plays, and by just doing the simple play and not worry about doing something too pretty? And he's been very good at that, very consistent at that. So I think that's one thing. But the bigger picture also is because you've got guys like Byron, Wheel, Lekkonen, who have not been very effective, the Canadians... Normally, the way they're structured are a team that you can move those wingers up and down the lineup depending on who's hot and who's not. And they're built as mainly a three-line threat. Right now, when you put Drouin with Domi on the second line and you've got other guys that are not producing, it looks like a team that has gone to a more traditional, old-school top six, bottom six.
Yeah.
And that will change the way the whole team is deployed. We've seen it against San Jose, but I'm really curious to see how it's going to be on the road, because the time on ice for the different forwards is really different on the road. The matchups are different. But you can see clearly that now Claude has entrusted the Domi line, and he it comes at the expense of Kotkaniemi, who's still being sheltered. But he had to take off if really he considered Drouin to be his best forward so far this season. He had to take him off Kotkaniemi's line if he wanted to continue to shelter Kotkaniemi.
Yeah, and I think actually by putting Lekkonen on that line and having Byron on that line, he might not feel the need to shelter Kotkaniemi as much as he did when Drouin was on that line. So
It's going to be a responsible line.
Yeah, it should be, because, you know, if if you ask me, I don't think Kotkaniemi needs to be as sheltered as he is. Personally, I think he's not an irresponsible defensive player. He's at times, I think this is what gives Claude reason to shelter him, is that against certain players, he's not as sturdy in board battles as Claude would like. Recently, in the last couple of games, we've seen some real demonstrations of physical play that we haven't seen from him.
That hit on Carlson.
He had a couple of similar ones in Minnesota. I mean, so it's he's trying to assert the fact that he's stronger and he feels stronger and he's confident in his strength. And I think he's realized that he needs to show his coach that in order to get more responsibilities. But, I think at some point it's going to come up where people are going to start, people were saying that, oh, we need to get Max Domi some better wingers offensively, someone who could put the puck in the net. So he gets Drouin, and I guarantee you within a week, if these lines stay the same, there's going to be an outcry to get, more offensive wingers for Kotkaniemi as well. Because if Byron doesn't figure it out and start putting the puck in the net or even getting scoring chances. I mean, that's the problem with Byron. It's not that he's not scoring.
No.
It's that he's not getting chances, and he's not noticeable. I mean, Claude mentioned it the other day, I think quite rightly, that, there are 3 to 4 times in every game where you notice Paul Byron, and he does something that makes you kind of stand up straight in your seat and take notice to what's going on the ice, and he hasn't done that. And if there was one game I was expecting him to do that in, it was in San Jose when everyone was, he had become the story.
Yeah.
De jour in Montreal, in the sense that he's struggling, going back to the concussion, the Mackenzie Weegar fight and all this stuff, and bringing all these other elements into it. Whereas, maybe that's something to do with it, maybe it doesn't, but he's just having a bad start to the season. And I think he's earned a certain level of benefit of doubt with his play since he's been in Montreal, but we need to see that burst from him, because if he doesn't have that burst, he's a very average NHL player all of a sudden.
Right.
And so that being on one wing, and then Arturi Lehkonen, who everyone concedes does a lot of things right, but does not put the puck in the net and has not done it to start this season either.
He does get chances, though. Contrary to Byron, he gets chances, but he'll miss the net.
Doesn't bury it. Yeah.
That's it.
doesn't bury it.
Yeah. Last night after the game against San Jose, when Julien mentioned the fact, when you're in the slot, you can't miss the net.
Yeah, that was the direct reference to Arturi Lehkonen, I think.
Yeah.
Last one, I think, that just before we wrap up, but we did mention how we wanted to discuss Ben Chiarot, and I think we should. So we're 10 games in, and I mentioned in passing the departure of Jordy Benn being the one difference on the penalty kill, so that he was replaced by Ben Chiarot. And Claude Julien, again, made another unnamed reference when talking about the penalty kill. He mentioned that we're spending too much time cross-checking guys in front of the net instead of looking for the puck, and that was a direct reference to Ben Chiarot. He didn't have to say it. He's been stuck in needless battles on the penalty kill, and even at 5-on-5, that he just doesn't need to get into, and seems to be just trying to over-assert the physical part of his game, because he knows that's why he was signed, maybe because he knows that's why Marc Bergevin has liked him since that's his identity.
That's
he's going over the top. He's not letting it come to him, those situations. The times when you assert yourself physically are organic. You can't create them. You can't go looking for them. And it seems to me that he's looking for them right now, and it's hurting his game.
Yeah, absolutely. And it hurts his game even more on the PK, where he's got the traditional profile of a guy who should be a good guy on the PK, and it's not the case. He's not helping right now in that sense.
Yeah. He's not that far behind Petry and Weber as far as goals allowed. He's right there.
Right, right. 5-on-5, I think that it's been better since he's been put on the third pairing. The way I view it, that guy is a number 5 defenseman. I still think that over the course of the season, with not only the physicality, but I think he's a fairly mobile player for his size. He'll try to do some stuff with the puck that's not too risky. I haven't seen him commit a lot of turnovers, unless he's under pressure in his own end. But I mean, like neutral zone turnovers, that sort of stuff.
He gets a surprising number of shots on goal.
Yeah,
he's good at getting the puck to the net.
Yeah,
so this hasn't been all bad.
No, and there's a There's a certain level, I think, that from game to game we can expect out of him. He's not like a jack-in-the-box type of player. So
he's not Mike Riley.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Or Jordy Benn to a certain extent.
Right.
Jordy Benn was, most of his time in Montreal, you did not always know what you would get. When he was on, he was really good. But it could be difficult at times. So is he an improvement over Jordy Benn? I think that in the long run, we'll say yes. But in the meantime, when we heard before the season both Claude Julien and Marc Bergevin saying, well, I think it was mostly Claude Julien saying, well, depending on the situation, depending on the matchup, we might see him next to Weber. To picture Sherratt as a potentially first-pairing defenseman was, I think, not the right read on the player and where he is in his career. Because he's
very similar to Marc Bergevin saying, we'll see Jordy Benn with Shea Weber before... Before last season, I think. I think going into last season at the golf tournament, he mentioned Jordy Benn as a potential partner for Shea Weber. So
yeah, so it's always...
It all ties together.
So I think right now he's in the right chair, and if the Canadians cannot find a way to get better by finding a legitimate top four defenseman to play on the left side, they could... try to go out and find someone to play with Sherratt on the third duo, maybe at the expense of Cale Fleury. But you know, Fleury, if he was to be sent down, it would not, I don't think it would be the end of the world. But if you strengthen, you know, it's that good old strong link, weak link principle, where in this case a weak link mentality would be to strengthen the third pairing so that they can take more minutes and ease off the burden on, for example, on Weber and Mete.
Mete, yeah.
So, and even Kulak, I mean, I haven't not been too enamored with his play the last couple of games. But you know, at the same time, Marc Bergevin was telling us, you know, I've always been a fan of Ben Sherratt since he was playing
in St. John's.
Exactly, in the American League. So he had his eyes on him for a long time. We'll probably question sooner rather than later also the amount of money that was thrown at this guy. And when you look
I think the last year of the deal is the one that's going to be problematic. The last year of the deal leaks into the sort of the cap Armageddon situation that the Canadians are facing. So
because it's a 3-year deal, exactly. Yeah.
So. But anyhow, I mean, I think, you know, as a first segment goes, we've seen worse with players trying to integrate into new teams. You know, I'm willing to give him a longer shot than that. I think it's fair to say the first segment of the season for Ben Sherratt has this first 10-game segment has not been great. It's been okay at best. At times, it's been bad. But I think, you know, I think if we're still having the same conversation in December, then there's a problem. But I'm willing to give him some benefit of the doubt because, you know, and I keep harping back on this, but the Jets wanted to keep him.
Yeah.
The Jets know him better than everyone, and they wanted to keep him. So we'll see with him. But I think we can...
The thing, though, is that, you know, if the trend continues and you have a third-pairing defenseman that you pay $3.5 million a year, that you have...
But that's lacking a first pairing defenseman that you're paying $8 million a year. So I mean, like, you're not paying your first pairing lefty $8 million, so you can afford to pay your third pairing lefty $3.5 million. It's not the end of the world. If you did have a proper first pairing lefty that you were paying a proper lefty salary, then you would say you don't pay a guy $3.5 million to play on your third pair. But if you're, you know, going back to your weak link, strong link theory, lacking the strong link on the first pair, you know, spending money on the third pair is not crazy to me. It just seems like a logical plan B if you cannot address the first pairing situation, which he has been unable to address for 2 years now.
Because having the money to sign that first pairing defenseman, if he's not accessible, if he's not available, or he doesn't exist,
is pointless.
It's pointless.
So let's wrap it up there. I just wanted to
give... we covered the whole roster today.
We did everything, it was a lot. Well, it's 10 games in. It's a proper time to kind of do a general assessment of things. So we'll be back on Monday with sort of an abbreviated version of the pod for subscribers only. It'll be available on the Athletic app, which will feature my interview with Cole Caufield in Madison, Wisconsin, when I was there on the weekend. So tune in for that on Monday.
Charming young man.
Very charming young man, very friendly, very nice, and you know, spent some time. And actually, we had a surprise appearance on the podcast portion of my interview from Corey Pronman, who like just couldn't resist jumping in and asking a few questions. So you'll get some Corey Pronman in there too, and you'll also get some guy who kept coming in the room and talking on the phone in the background. But that's a story for Monday. I'll explain that on Monday leading into the pod. But aside from that, I'll be at the game against the Maple Leafs and, you know, continue reading everything we're doing over at The Athletic. And we'll see you Monday.
All right. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you.